In December of 1815, just over 200 years ago, the defeated former emperor Napoleon Bonaparte was transported to what is known as Longwood House on the remote Atlantic island of St. Helena. Longwood House was not a very well-maintained place to live. There's a lot of mold in the house. It wasn't well-maintained or taken care of. So within a very short time, within 6 years, on May the 5th of 1821, Napoleon, who had suffered a serious decline in his health over that period of time, he died. The British, of course, would bury him there on St. Helena. He had an autopsy before he was buried, and the autopsy, ironically, would be unsigned, and it would declare that his death was due to stomach cancer. He would be buried, and time would go on. About 20 years later, in 1840, the French wanted to get the body of Napoleon back and give it a proper burial in Paris. So they obtained permission from the British, and Napoleon's body would be exhumed on the island of St. Helena and relocated to France. It was a rather shocking discovery, though, when they exhumed Napoleon's body. It had not decomposed, as one would assume, after almost 20 years. His body was actually quite well preserved. Chemical testing would reveal that he had high levels of arsenic in his body, throughout his body, as well as in his hair. And arsenic, as some of you may know, serves as a great preservative. And this led to many suspicions when the news got out, led to many suspicions that perhaps Napoleon had been poisoned. During the 1800s, arsenic was one of the most prevalent poisons. It was used to murder lots of people at that time period. And Slate.com published an article in 2006 with the catchy title, "Don't Chew the Wallpaper." It was written by David Kevels. And David Kevels is a historian at the University of Yale. And he wrote this article as a history of the use of poison. And he presented a rather interesting theory about Napoleon's demise. He said, quote, "At the end of the 19th century, Italian scientist Bartolomeo Gassio was prompted to investigate why so many Italian children were inexplicably sickening and dying. Physicians suspected arsenic poisoning. All the symptoms made them think that, but they couldn't discover how was it that all of these children had been exposed to arsenic in a large enough scale to actually cause them to die." Article continues, "Gassio demonstrated that a microorganism that grew on the flour paste backing of the wallpaper could turn the arsenic in it into a gas that was powerful enough to make people ill and even kill them. The green, arsenic-rich pigment in the wallpaper's star pattern at Longwood House may have led to Napoleon's death." Of course, we don't know, but there's a theory there, at least, that maybe he was accidentally poisoned by the wallpaper. More recent studies who investigated Napoleon's death seem to support the idea that he actually died of stomach cancer. Yet the underlying suspicion that Napoleon may have been poisoned, the list of the possible suspects goes on and on. Maybe it was the British. Maybe it was the husband of one of his mistresses, and the list goes on. This idea that he may have been poisoned to death persists even today. The use of poisons, after all, to dispatch an opponent, has a long history in the account of mankind. I found out in researching this topic that during the 1800s, arsenic was so commonly used in France to kill people that it became known as the poudre de succession, which in English essentially means inheritance powder. If you wanted to have an inheritance, go to the apothecary, buy a little bit of arsenic, and clear the line of succession for yourself. It was used to clear relatives, to remove witnesses of crimes, and to eliminate competition. It's quite a positive tool if that's what a person wanted to do. Arsenic, as most poisons go, included several advantages. If you wanted to kill a person, you could use it in secret. No one needed to know that you had actually killed the person. Oftentimes, you could use a poison and go unnoticed. After all, it was very easy to sneak a small vial of arsenic into a house, slip it into someone's tea, and then they died. It'd be much more difficult to hire an assailant to sneak into the house and kill the person. Arsenic often looked similar to daily items. In fact, it was used in medicine, it was used in wallpaper, and the like. It also had the advantage for a would-be assassin in that it conquered a person from within. There wasn't any concrete evidence, necessarily, that a crime had even been committed. And perhaps most advantageous for an assassin, arsenic, like most poisons, was often misdiagnosed as other ailments. It would create a host of symptoms, and people would often die of natural causes. The incidents, thankfully, involving poison have been limited over the most recent years. But poisoning, whether it would be intentional or accidental, even because of carelessness, still exists today. And when we think about ourselves as members of God's church, Satan, our arch enemy, and his many instruments of spiritual warfare, he includes an arsenal of spiritual poisons. So in the sermon this afternoon, I'd like for us to examine one of the most insidious and devastatingly effective spiritual poisons that Satan uses. This device of Satan carries all the hallmarks of effective poisons. It's often silent. Many times individuals who've been attacked by this don't even recognize that it's happened. It's easily transmitted, sometimes from person to person. This poison produces in humans a rash of symptoms which can often hide the underlying trigger. And sadly, this spiritual poison can prove to be quite lethal. We find in Scripture that it's actually presented as a poison. Turn with me to Acts chapter 8. We'll see where we are given reference to this topic. Of course, in Acts chapter 8, we have the account of Philip the deacon, who would go to the city of Samaria, and he would preach about the kingdom of God and what God expected of those that he would call. And it says that many responded to his teaching. And among those that responded was a gentleman named Simon. He's called Simon, who practiced sorcery. He's sometimes connected with Simon Magus, perhaps. But Simon the sorcerer, he heard and he responded to Philip's teaching. He liked what Philip had to say. And then Peter and John came, laid hands on individuals, and God granted them the gift of the Holy Spirit. And to Simon, this was something that appealed to him. He wanted to have this power as well. So much so that he actually offered money to buy the authority to lay hands on individuals so they could receive the gift of the Holy Spirit. That's where the term simony comes from. So we pick up this story in Acts chapter 8, and verse 23, Peter gives a rather stark rebuke to Simon for this suggestion. And in the midst of his explanation in verse 23, he says, "For I see," this is Peter talking to Simon, "for I see that you are poisoned by bitterness and bound by iniquity." He says that this gentleman, Simon, had been poisoned by bitterness. Bitterness has a variety of definitions, but it can be defined as festering resentment, as unrestrained cynicism, intense antagonism, or intense hostility. Bitterness, in all the definitions, often reflects a lack of emotional control. There's a degree of intensity or strength that's applied to the emotion in question. It's not just resentment, it's a festering resentment. It's not merely antagonism or hostility, but it's an intense antagonism directed toward others. Scripture also likens bitterness to a root. Let's go over to Hebrews chapter 12, and let's see where this analogy is used to describe bitterness. Hebrews chapter 12, and notice verse 15. We're breaking into this thought about the importance of godly character. And in verse 15, it says, "Looking carefully, lest anyone fall short of the grace of God, lest any root of bitterness springing up cause trouble, and by this many become defiled." This poison of bitterness is described here as being a root. It's compared to a root, and that makes sense. A root is often, after all, something hidden. We don't think of roots when we see trees very often. After all, the roots are underground. They're hidden, out of sight, and yet growing. The same thing can happen with bitterness. Bitterness can lay out of sight without anyone seeing it, and yet it can grow internally and choke our hearts, as we'll see later. This matches a stern warning from God to ancient Israel in Deuteronomy 19 and verse 18, where he said, "There may not be among you man or woman or family or tribe whose heart turns away from the Lord our God to go and serve the gods of these nations, and that there may not be among you a root bearing bitterness or wormwood." Bitterness is not something that God tolerates among his people. Yet God, with his understanding of the human heart, places emphasis on preventing and eliminating this spiritual poison from our lives. We likely all know individuals who have succumbed to bitterness over time, perhaps even ourselves in certain occasions. We see this in society, and we certainly see this throughout history. In fact, countries have even been driven to war by leaders who were bitter for one reason or another. Marriages have been dissolved, families have broken up, close friends and family and coworkers have come to blows because of bitterness. Bitterness, and comparing it to a poison, is an apt comparison. As a weapon, poisons often carry the advantage of being stealthy. People don't see it coming before the devastating blow is dealt. One of the most famous incidents of poisoning in the last 40 years or so occurred in 1978. I'm sure many of you have heard the story. Individual's name was Georgi Markov, and he was a Bulgarian defector. He had defected from Bulgaria in 1969. He went on to become a journalist in Britain, and he gave a weekly Radio Free Europe broadcast, as well as numerous BBC broadcasts, each week in which he would expose the abuses under communism. On September the 7th, 1978, when Georgi was on his way to work in London, he was at a bus stop waiting for his bus in a crowd of people who were likewise waiting, and he felt a sharp pain in the back of his leg. It was just for a moment. He recollected reaching down to rub the back of his leg and hearing someone say they were sorry as they picked up their umbrella, and he made his way to work. He wasn't at work long before he began complaining about feeling ill. He ended up being taken to the hospital, and 4 days later, on September the 11th, he died. When they did an autopsy, they found a small pellet in his leg. It was the size of a pinhead, and it had been laced with ricin, just a small amount, coated with wax, so that once it had been injected into his leg, his body temperature would melt the wax away, and he essentially poisoned himself. The killer was never identified. No one noticed who did it. And he or she was never apprehended. It's still an open case today, even in Britain. But it shows how poisons can so quickly and so stealthily come to attack a person. Bitterness works in the same fashion. Bitterness can often be surreptitiously planted in the human heart. It often begins with something small, something seemingly insignificant, something so small or trivial, yet it becomes stuck in the human heart like a barnacle. It just latches on and stays there. And then it becomes fed by human emotions. It becomes a spiritual parasite, if you will, which establishes a symbiotic relationship with the most negative of emotive responses. It lives there, if you will, figuratively, in a person's heart, and it feeds off of the worst emotions possible. And as those emotions and actions become more prevalent, the bitterness grows stronger in strength and stamina every day. There are a number of terrible human emotions and responses that actively feed bitterness. Perhaps the most common would be jealousy or envy. Let's take a look at an example of this in Genesis chapter 16. Jealousy and envy, if not dealt with swiftly, serve as a feeding trough for bitterness in the human heart. Let's go to Genesis chapter 16. And we'll look at the example of Sarah and Hagar. Genesis chapter 16, we're going to begin in verse 1. Of course, we know at this point God has called Abram. Abram has responded to God's calling. And God has begun to give Abram a number of promises about what will come to his family because of Abram's faithfulness. And among those promises is this family that's going to be numbered as the stars of heaven or the sand of the sea. Of course, they're waiting then naturally for a child. Genesis 16 and verse 1, it says, "Now Sarai, Abram's wife, had borne him no children. And she had an Egyptian maidservant whose name was Hagar." So Sarai, of course, we know the story. They've been waiting for children, and they haven't been able to have any. Verse 2, "So Sarai said to Abram, 'See now, the Lord has restrained me from bearing children. Please go into my maid. Perhaps I shall obtain children by her.' And Abram heeded the voice of Sarai. Then Sarai, Abram's wife, took Hagar, her maid, the Egyptian, and gave her to her husband Abram to be his wife, after Abram had dwelt 10 years in the land of Canaan." Verse 4, "So he went into Hagar, and she conceived." And notice what happens immediately. "And when she saw that she had conceived, her mistress became despised in her eyes." Now her mistress, it was her mistress's idea, was Sarai's idea, to elevate Hagar, essentially, from just being a maidservant to being a wife of Abram. But now we see the tables begin to turn. Verse 5, it goes on, "Then Sarai said to Abram, 'My wrong be upon you. I gave my maid into your embrace, and when she saw that she had conceived, I became despised in her eyes. The Lord judge between you and me.' So Abram said to Sarai, 'Indeed, your maid is in your hand. Do to her as you please.' And when Sarai dealt harshly with her, she fled from her presence." You can imagine this situation and how tense it must have been. Sarai's idea to circumvent God's plan doesn't produce the harmony that she was looking for. It doesn't create harmony. Instead, it creates jealousy and envy that over the years would fester and produce bitterness. Turn forward to Genesis 21, and we'll pick up the story a number of years later. Of course, the years have gone by, and you can imagine, it'd be interesting to talk to them about it in the kingdom, about what it was like during this gap in time. But you can imagine that it wasn't a happy home life for these individuals. Genesis 21 and verse 1 says, "And the Lord visited Sarah as he had said, and the Lord did for Sarah as he had spoken." In God's timing, his plan always works out. "For Sarah conceived and bore Abraham a son in his old age at the set time of which God had spoken to him. And Abraham called the name of his son who was born to him, whom Sarah bore to him, Isaac. Then Abraham circumcised his son Isaac when he was 8 days old, as God had commanded him. Now Abraham was 100 years old when his son Isaac was born to him, and Sarah said, 'God has made me laugh, and all who hear will laugh with me.' She also said, 'Who would have said to Abraham that Sarah would nurse children, for I have borne him a son in his old age?' So the child grew and was weaned. And Abraham made a great feast on the same day that Isaac was weaned. And Sarah saw the son of Hagar the Egyptian, whom she had borne to Abraham, scoffing. Therefore she said to Abraham, 'Cast out this bondwoman and her son, for the son of this bondwoman shall not be heir with my son, namely with Isaac.'" You can see this long-running dispute that festered into bitterness because of jealousy and envy, so much so that Sarah wants Abraham to have Hagar and Ishmael removed. And the penalty and the product of this relationship continues to plague mankind even today. Another emotion that feeds bitterness is uncontrolled anger. Turn with me over to James chapter 1. We have a commentary here on the anger of mankind. An uncontrolled anger, anger that is not within the control of a person, can often produce bitterness. James chapter 1 and verse 19 and 20. James 1 verse 19 and 20. It says, "So then, my beloved brethren, let every man be swift, be quick to hear, slow to speak, slow to wrath. For the wrath of man does not produce the righteousness of God." The uncontrolled anger of mankind does not produce righteousness. Instead, it often leads to bitterness. Think about individuals that you may have known in your life that you would describe as a bitter person. Oftentimes they're angry, filled with anger, especially if you touch on whatever point they're bitter about, whether it would be a perceived or even a real wrong or slight. If you touch on that subject, they often respond with uncontrolled anger. Another emotion or emotive response of humans that feeds bitterness is pride. Perhaps the person's not recognized for their abilities. Perhaps correction is not well delivered, and the human heart responds with pride. That pride left unchecked can often fester into bitterness. We won't turn there, as we know the story in Isaiah 14 and Ezekiel 28. Those two chapters tell and reveal the story about Lucifer's fall. Lucifer suffered from pride. Pride that turned to sin and then festered into bitterness. Pride left unaddressed often settles into bitterness. And that, of course, in Satan's case, led to his ill-fated revolt against God. And the same thing can happen to humans. If we allow pride to be unchecked in our own spiritual lives, it can turn into bitterness and lead us down a path of rebellion against God. Perhaps one of the most obvious and most frequent emotive responses that leads to bitterness is allowing ourselves to be easily offended, to take offense at an action by others, even in some cases an action by God. One of the best examples of this is the story of Joseph's brothers. So let's go back to Genesis chapter 7. We see an example of what happens when individuals allow themselves to take offense and then don't properly deal with it. This morning, Emily and I watched the Friday Night Live from last night, and Mr. Kylo talked about forgiveness. And one of the things he talked about was this concept of being able to deal with offenses properly, that offenses certainly do come. So it's not that we'll go through life without facing offenses. We will be offended at some point in life. If your last name's Hyde, for example, and you make it through elementary school, you'll be given the opportunity to be offended many, many times. I know there's others in here who share last names that have equally been plagued with joyful ridicule, perhaps. Nonetheless, offenses will certainly come, and it's how we choose to deal with those that determines whether those offenses create and generate bitterness in our lives. So here in Genesis chapter 37, verse 1, it says, "Now Jacob dwelt in the land where his father was a stranger, in the land of Canaan." And then in verse 3, it continues with the account. Genesis chapter 37 and verse 3, it says, "Now Israel," Jacob, "loved Joseph more than all his children, because he was the son of his old age. Also, he made him a tunic of many colors. But when his brothers saw their father loved him more than all his brothers, they hated him and could not speak peaceably to him." One of the best things about this example when it comes to taking offense is that initially the brothers were in the right. Israel should not have chosen one of his children above the others to love. The fault initially was with Israel. He gave Joseph treatment that allowed the other brothers to feel unloved. He elevated him among all the others. He made sure it was known within the family that he, as the father, loved Joseph more than all the rest. He went out of his way to make sure they understood, you're my sons, but you're not as good as this one. So initially, the brothers were technically in the right. They had been offended by their father, and their father had done wrong. But they chose not to handle that offense properly. There's no account where they went and tried to talk to their father about it and tried to explain how his actions had impacted them. Instead, they hated Joseph and could not speak peaceably to him. They were unable to control their reaction. Of course, we go down verses 5 through 10, and Joseph, in his lack of wisdom, shares his dreams that God had gave him. He shares these dreams with his brothers, which just amplifies the problem. Then we come to verse 11. It said, and his brothers envied him. So here we've got anger and we've got envy, and they're upset with their father about this treatment that their brothers received. And this turns into bitterness. So much so in verse 18, notice what they do. The situation has gotten very dire in this family. Now when they saw him afar off, even before he came near them, they conspired against him to kill him. Imagine this happening in your family. Time has gone by and this offense is not properly dealt with, and now these young men have decided to conspire together to kill their own brother. Verse 19, we see their attitude. Then they said to one another, look, this dreamer is coming. Come, therefore, let us now kill him and cast him into some pit. And we shall say, some wild beast has devoured him. We shall see what will become of his dreams. You can see they were offended by his dreams, and now they decided, well, we'll just wipe him out and throw him in a pit, and we'll deal with this. In verse 28, the situation grows even worse. Imagine if this was your family. What must have been going through Joseph's mind and the minds of his brothers? Because they've kind of tabled this idea of killing him and put him in the pit. And then in verse 28, then the Midianite traders passed by. So the brothers pulled Joseph up and lifted him out of the pit and sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver. And they took Joseph to Egypt. Imagine what that must have been like for Joseph and his brothers. This last account, the sons of Jacob, demonstrates the poisonous power of bitterness. Once planted in the human heart, bitterness grows, often unchecked, beneath the surface like a root. Remember what we read in Hebrews 12 and verse 15, where it said, look carefully lest anyone fall short of the grace of God, lest any root of bitterness springing up cause trouble. The New Living Translation renders that phrase, watch out that no poisonous root of bitterness grows up to trouble you. The phrase grows up or springs up, the Greek word is phuo, and it means to germinate, to grow, to sprout, or to produce. And bitterness can act like a root in the human heart. It can grow out of sight and become quite powerful. Roots are generally underground. Occasionally you'll see trees that have been overturned, but most roots are underground. They're hidden away, often unnoticed, and yet they are quite powerful. There's a tremendous amount of work and development that takes place underground before a plant ever breaks the surface of the ground or is even noticeable. If you were to use Google and Google the word root and look at the images, you'll see hundreds of images that show plants above and below ground. And oftentimes it'll be a very small plant, but the root network that's hidden away that you can't see is quite large. And bitterness can function the same way in a human heart. Festering under the surface, in the back of our minds, or hidden in the depths of our heart, bitterness can sprout up in our lives if left unchecked, if we attempt to just leave it there without dealing with it. It seems hard to believe in this account here in Genesis 37 that the brothers started out with murderous intent. It wasn't as though the day that Joseph was born, they all banded together and wanted to kill him. It took years for this mindset to develop. But bitterness, once planted, shared, stoked, and fueled by conversation and shared offenses, began to produce destructive fruit in their lives, so much so that they reached the point where they were willing to kill their own brother. Like most poisons, bitterness produces distinct symptoms and is manifested in human lives in very destructive behavior. We'll just look at a few of those, kind of the product of bitterness in the human heart. Bitterness often produces anger. I said earlier that anger often causes bitterness, and we'll see that most of these become cyclical. Anger produces bitterness if left unchecked, and that bitterness, if allowed to fester in the human heart, produces even more anger, even to the point of violence if it's not dealt with properly. And this anger that bitterness produces is not righteous indignation. Now, a person who's suffering from bitterness will often try to convince themselves that their anger that they're feeling is some sort of righteous indignation. But the anger produced by bitterness will never be righteous. Another symptom of bitterness that sometimes manifests in humans is sarcasm. Now, not all sarcasm is a fruit of bitterness. It can be part of a sense of humor. But sarcasm at times can be a symptom of inner bitterness. It can be a reflection of unchecked bitterness. If comments are always chiding or negative, there's a good chance that those chiding or negative comments may be rooted in bitterness. Another byproduct of bitterness is that bitterness destroys work ethic. Individuals who are bitter often give up their work ethic. This is quite often demonstrated physically, and we think about ourselves spiritually, it can affect our spiritual work ethic as well. For example, bitter employees, if they're bitter because they didn't get a promotion, if they're bitter because they weren't rated highly enough, maybe they're bitter because they were asked to do an unpopular task. Oftentimes, employees who allow themselves to become bitter will choose the immature, passive-aggressive response. They'll just shut down. Maybe they'll declare openly, well, I'm not going to do anything else. I'm going to do the minimum. I'm not going to work hard if I'm not appreciated. The same thing can be manifested spiritually if we allow bitterness to take root in our hearts. Bitterness also often produces foolish thoughts and actions that are devoid of wisdom or judgment. Individuals who suffer from bitterness often spout out rash comments without thinking about the impact of those words. They may choose to pout. You see this in small children when they allow bitterness to get into their small little hearts. And as a child, my dad would tell me to stop dragging your feet because he knew I was upset about something and I had a chore to do. So, you know, you kind of walk. Walking as slowly as you possibly can. And it was an outward symptom of an inner problem that he wanted me to deal with. Well, the same thing can happen to us spiritually also. And perhaps the most dangerous in some ways byproduct of bitterness is that if we allow bitterness to take up root in our heart, it can lead to the inability to forgive. A heart that is just wrapped up in bitterness has almost lost the capacity to forgive. This becomes very important later in a person's spiritual life because the inability to forgive, as Mr. Kylo brought out last night in Friday Night Live, can really destroy a person spiritually. Bitterness is like a taproot. It's like those weeds that grow so plentifully in the yard. Dandelions, for example, the bane of our existence at times, or those thorny weeds that take over our yard. You can mow them, and you can weed eat them, and cut them right down to the surface and think they're gone. And then you come back the next day, and there's this beautiful dandelion there waiting for you, already blooming. You can cut it down. To get rid of it, you really have to dig deep and pull out the taproot. And the same thing is the way it applies to bitterness. It can be very challenging and difficult to remove bitterness from our lives. It requires patience, determination, self-examination, and of course the Spirit and the help of God. We go through this list of things that bitterness produces, and you could add to the list, the cyclical nature of bitterness becomes quite clear. As these destructive fruits are produced, whether it would be anger, the inability to forgive, as those things are produced in our lives, bitterness grows stronger. The more bitter a person becomes, the harder it is to forgive, the more anger they have toward others. As they have more anger and the inability to forgive, the bitterness in their heart takes an even more deadly hold. Bitterness is truly a deadly poison. Not all poisons will kill you. Some poisons aren't life-threatening. They may provide mild discomfort and even sickness. But some poisons are lethal. Just a small amount of ricin, for example, will kill a person. Some poisons are so toxic that by their very nature, they destroy life. And I believe on the sliding scale of spiritual poisons, bitterness may be among the most deadly, especially from a spiritual perspective. Obviously, it sustains and perpetuates so many negative emotions and human behaviors. We went through a list there earlier. Each of those behaviors has multiple negative, in some cases, lasting consequences. If you just take anger, bitterness often produces anger. And if a person becomes enraged all the time, that affects their family life, their work life, it affects their coworkers, their colleagues, their friends, and the list goes on and on. Bitterness, however, is even more vile than that, because bitterness has the power to actually alter how we think, how we experience, and how we interpret the actions of others, and most importantly, the actions of God. This is quite scary, really. Bitterness can alter how we as humans think, experience, and interpret the actions of God. Because bitterness often leads a person to impugn motives that may not exist at all, to ascribe malicious or evil intent where none exists. You've likely seen this with individuals who are so bitter about a topic that they can never see reason. No matter what a person says, they're still going to be angry because they've lost their ability to interpret or even see reality. It often leads to the exaggeration of small or insignificant actions or experiences and transforms them into major spiritual roadblocks. I've used this example before, but I think it speaks to this. My family knew an individual who left the Church of God because, in their words, someone stole the last banana in a potluck line. Now, you can imagine, this is a small incident, really. I mean, someone took the last banana, they had their eye on the banana, they wanted that banana, and someone else took it. And you can imagine that that wasn't the only reason they left the Church of God. But in their minds, as they relate it, that was the final straw. Imagine actually saying those words. I left the church because so-and-so stole the last banana. I mean, what a small incident. But because of the bitterness that they had developed over a number of years, when they saw someone ahead of them in line take the banana off the potluck line, in their mind, what they saw was someone stole the banana from me. In their case, them. That wasn't really what happened. Now, we don't know the motivation of the person who took the last banana. Maybe they did want to take it because they knew Bob or whoever the person's name was interested in the banana. Seems unlikely. But in this person's mind, and they suffered from bitterness, in their mind, the person who took that banana stole it from them. Their version of what happened had no basis in reality. Do we really think that person who took the banana was actually out to steal it from this person? I mean, after all, there's going to be bananas at the grocery store. It's not as though it's the last banana on earth. But this shows how the human mind, how the ability to think, to reason, to understand and experience and interpret the actions of others can be altered by this poison of bitterness. Because in this person's mind, it didn't matter what happened. They had already come to this conclusion that everyone out, and this particular person was out to get them, so they stole the banana, final straw, they left the church. See, bitterness changes a human's ability to actually see reality. Rather, a person who suffers from bitterness left unchecked only sees what they interpret. The person's perception of what happened becomes their reality. You've likely experienced this where you have two or more people in a conversation and they walk away from the conversation with completely different recollections of what actually transpired. Bitterness coaxes and coerces the human heart into lying to itself and then convincing itself that the lie is truth. In this one example, the person lied to themselves that the person stole the banana from them, and then they convinced themselves that that lie was actually true. Doing that leads to fatal errors in judgment, in decisions, and actions. And see, bitterness as a poison affects all of our relationships. It serves to separate and divide the person who's experiencing bitterness from everyone else. This can happen in marriage. Take a look at Colossians chapter 3. This is an important enough topic that Paul was inspired to specifically address bitterness when it comes to marriage. Colossians chapter 3, and we'll read verse 19. There's a number of verses here that talk about how a Christian home should operate and the different roles that individuals fill. But notice verse 19, Colossians 3, verse 19. Husbands, love your wives and do not be bitter toward them. Because if bitterness takes hold, if it takes root in a person's life, in a marriage, in this example, if it's not properly dealt with, that bitterness will grow and will fester and will destroy that relationship. Of course, we know how important family is to God. If you destroy a marriage, sometimes you can destroy the family and then it breaks down. We see that with families, with communities, and then even nations. Bitterness also can alter our relationship with God. It's not just our relationship with other people, but bitterness left unchecked can alter our relationship with God. Bitterness toward God can destroy hope, it can destroy faith, and it can lead a person to indict God in our minds. Indicting God of imaginary crimes. God didn't provide for me. God didn't deliver me. God's not faithful to his word. If we allow bitterness to take root, it can lead us down that road. Bitterness prevents individuals from seeing ourselves and growing. We cannot effectively be a Christian without self-examination and purposeful spiritual growth. But the insidious nature of bitterness is that it clouds our vision. We can't see ourselves properly any longer. And it can at times even lead to self-justification. Well, it's okay that I'm responding this way because, after all, that person stole the last banana in the potluck line. So it leads to behavior that can be quite detrimental. All too often, bitterness, like some poisons, is self-inflicted. We can ignore it or not pay attention to it and allow it to creep into our lives. So what then, as Christians, should we do about it? Well, poisoning in a human life requires immediate attention. Here in the United States, we have the American Association of Poison Control Centers. They have a 1-800 number that's available 24 hours a day 7 days a week. And their mission is to prevent and treat poison exposures. And the reason they're open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, is because the timely diagnosis and treatment of poisoning is critical to preserve life, and beyond that, to preserve the quality of life for the person who's been the victim. Well, the same is true for us spiritually. If we consider bitterness a poison, we must take swift action to get it out by the root. We cannot settle for just window dressing when it comes to bitterness. Bitterness cannot be allowed to be ignored in our spiritual life. If we recognize that perhaps there's an area of our life where we have bitterness and it's beginning to take root, we can't afford to ignore it, because like any good root, bitterness will grow and will spread in the human heart if it's left to live there. You can't paper over, cover over, or like a weed, you can't just trim off the top of bitterness. You have to dig down and remove the root entirely. And this takes serious work, because bitterness, like all tap roots, goes down very deep. It likes to stay around, and it's very difficult to get rid of it. It begins with an acknowledgement, of course, and repentance. I would submit to you that there's a number of things individuals could do to prevent and effectively treat any kind of bitterness poisoning. We're going to look at three of these today, three things that we could actively do to either prevent, or if we have identified we have a problem with bitterness in an area of our life, this is how we can effectively treat bitterness. And the first point is that we as humans should concentrate on humility. Concentrate on humility. Turn over to Ephesians chapter 4. Ephesians chapter 4, we'll read verse 31 and 32. Ephesians 4, verse 31 and 32. We're breaking into a number of really bullet points where we're instructed on how to live and what to do in our life. But Ephesians 4 and verse 31, it says, let all bitterness, wrath, anger, clamor, and evil speaking be put away from you with all malice. Verse 32, and be kind to one another, tender-hearted, forgiving one another, even as God in Christ forgave you. If we want to prevent the growth of bitterness in our own lives, we should concentrate on humility. Humility is an ongoing antidote to bitterness. Humility focuses our attention on our own behaviors, our own motivations, our own decisions, and our own actions. Not out of self-promotion, but to look at ourselves and say, what can we do to contribute to the health or the blessing of this situation, whatever we find ourselves in? Humility goes directly against bitterness. Bitterness, by its nature, is consumed with selfish desire. Humility is concerned with self-change, changing ourselves to walk in the image of God. Humility trains the human heart to give the benefit of doubt. If we learn to walk with humility, we'll be more apt to give the benefit of the doubt to others. Humility trains the human heart not to exalt our own opinion. Isn't any wonder that Jesus opened the Sermon on the Mount with these words, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven." You can find that in Matthew 5 and verse 3. 2 verses later, he said, "Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth." Humility drives humans to seek wise counsel. By their very nature, the more humble we are, the more open we are to wise counsel. We want to seek wisdom so that we can improve in our own lives, in our own walk. Humility drives a human to listen, to examine our own hearts and motivations, to walk prudently, to seek peace, and most of all, to forgive. An individual who walks with humility is prone to forgiveness. All of these actions that are a fruit of humility serve to block the rooting of bitterness. It's hard to grow bitter if a person is walking in humility. Let's go to James chapter 3. James chapter 3, and we'll begin reading in verse 13. James 3 and verse 13. Who is wise? Who is understanding among you? Let him show by good conduct that his works are done in the meekness of wisdom. A person is walking with humility. Verse 14, but if you have bitter envy and self-seeking in your hearts, do not boast and lie against the truth. This wisdom, the idea of bitter envy and self-seeking, self-promotion, this wisdom does not descend from above, but is earthly, sensual, demonic. For where envy and self-seeking exist, confusion and every evil thing are there. But the wisdom that is from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, willing to yield, full of mercy and good fruits, without partiality and without hypocrisy. I would submit that if we want to prevent bitterness from ever taking root in our heart, we should concentrate on humility, work to walk with meekness, to be poor in spirit before God, to maintain that attitude in our interactions with everyone, because it serves to push bitterness away. A second key to preventing or effectively treating bitterness poisoning is to ensure that we have an appropriate relationship with God, to have an appropriate relationship with God. This may be self-evident. We might think, well, duh. But it's important because bitterness serves to destroy the appropriate relationship with God. Bitterness skews the relationship that a person may already have with God. To prevent, and where necessary, to eradicate bitterness, we must develop and maintain an appropriate perspective on God. And for humans, this can be difficult. This requires that we accept that God is in control and he has his divine prerogative, and we don't always know what that will be. One of the best examples of this is found in the book of Job. I'm not going to turn there. I'm just going to quote it to you since we turned there a couple of weeks ago. But this account is in Job chapter 1, verses 20 through 22. Of course, we know what happened with Job. He receives all this stunning news. He's lost his wealth. He's lost his servants. And finally, the news comes that Job has lost his family. If you want to think about it, the attitude of a person, if Job suffered from bitterness, the human response to this news would be to attack or indict God. How, God, did you let this happen? You said you would provide for me, and now look at what's happened. You gave me children to love, and now you have taken them from me. You gave me wealth, and now you've taken it from me. That would be the human response if Job suffered from bitterness. But that's not what happened in Job's case. Verse 20 says, then Job arose, tore his robe, and shaved his head, and fell to the ground and worshiped. See, Job had an appropriate relationship with God. Job's perspective, when it came to his relationship with God, was that God was in charge, and God had the divine right and prerogative to do his will and plan. And Job knew that God's plan would ultimately be right. Goes on and says, and he, Job, said, naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked shall I return there. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. In all this, Job did not sin nor charge God with wrong. His attitude, like that of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, we remember their account, when they were taken before the fiery furnace, and they told the king, our God can intervene to deliver us from you. But if not, if that's not his will, were willing to die in the fiery furnace. It was the same attitude that Jesus of Nazareth demonstrated when he said, "Not my will, but your will be done." It was the proper type of relationship that we as Christians should have with God. Bitterness gets in between that relationship. Bitterness toward God develops when we allow our view toward God to be altered, to improperly indict God for our own perceived wrongs. If we want to prevent and eradicate bitterness in our lives, we must develop the appropriate, contented, thankful approach to God. Your will be done. And the last key that we'll look at today to prevent and effectively treat bitterness is that we must have the spiritual maturity and self-control to practice Matthew chapter 18. If we want to eliminate bitterness in our relationships and in our lives, we must have the spiritual maturity and the self-control to practice Matthew chapter 18. Most bitterness in human affairs involves our relationship with other people. Bitterness with friends. Bitterness, unfortunately, in a marriage. Bitterness with our children or with our parents, or the relationship as parent and child. Bitterness between brothers and sisters in the household of faith. Bitterness with the administration, with the ministers, and the like. Bitterness between ourselves and coworkers or colleagues. See, that unfortunately, the general human response to conflict, to offense, and bitterness is to withdraw, to gossip, and make the situation worse. It inflates a human's importance in the eyes of others and is terribly destructive. We read recently Proverbs 16 and verse 28, where it says, "A perverse man sows strife, and a whisperer, a gossip, separates the best of friends." Well, God provides an antidote to bitterness in our human relationships. And we find this in Matthew chapter 18. Let's turn over there. This approach is by no means easy for humans. And yet, it serves as an antidote to eliminate or at least treat bitterness that may arise in our relationships with humans. Matthew chapter 18 and verse 15. It says, "Moreover, if your brother sins against you, go and tell the neighborhood his fault and gain strength for yourself." Wait, that's not the translation. Verse 15. "Moreover, if your brother sins against you, go and tell him his fault between you and him alone. If he hears you, you have gained your brother." The proper means to handle offenses is provided for us here. It's not easy to do. I'm not suggesting that this is easy for a human to do. And you could perhaps have a whole message on how to do this. That's not the point today. But this is the antidote that God provides us for bitterness that develops between and among people. A few years ago at camp, I had the oldest group of guys, and something came up about a disagreement. And we had read this verse, and I asked the guys one night, I said, "What's the point here? Is the point of this to go and correct the brother?" And several of them, of course, the ones that are more boisterous, went, "Oh yeah, that's right. You want to go and tell them and make sure they know and change them." Well, that's not really the point. The point of this passage is to gain the brother. The intent behind this interaction is to gain the brother. Not at any cost, not to compromise with truth, but the attitude, the approach, the desire that's utilized from the very beginning in this approach is the desire to humbly gain a brother, to be able to lovingly take an offense, address it privately, with the intent of not to show you how terrible you are, but to actually gain the brother. We find this in the very definition of love. In 1 Corinthians 13 and verse 5, it said, "Love does not dishonor others. It is not self-seeking. It is not easily angered. It keeps no record of wrongs. The attitude that goes into these exchanges is one of humility. And Matthew 18 and verse 15 applies to both the giver and the receiver of the feedback. As we read earlier in James 3 and verse 17, the wisdom that is from above is easy to be entreated. It's a person who's developed godly wisdom has the attitude of if they're on the receiving end of the feedback, they're easily entreated. They're not immediately hostile and wanting to lash back with a response. Rather, they have the wisdom to be easily approached and to resolve those situations in a loving manner. We should apply Matthew 18 and verse 15 to all of our human relationships. Wherever offenses occur, and boy do they happen to all of us, we can allow those offenses to fester and become bitterness, or we can apply Matthew chapter 18 and verse 15 and handle those responsibly and prevent bitterness from ever entering our heart. We should apply this to our marriage, to our parenting with our children, and our being parented with our parents, to our friendships, and to our relationships within the church of God. Matthew chapter 18 and verse 15 requires forgiveness. And if you study the topic of bitterness, you'll quickly learn that bitterness cannot survive and exist in an environment of forgiveness. Simply can't happen. If we develop the character to forgive, bitterness in our heart cannot continue to exist. And Matthew 18 and verse 15 requires the attitude of forgiveness. The barnacle of bitterness is cast off and removed from the human heart if we apply with wisdom Matthew 18 and verse 15. We must develop the spiritual maturity and the self-control to practice this if we want to effectively treat bitterness poisoning. With better forensics, the incidence of intentional poisoning have declined over the last 200 years. There was a time when numerous people were poisoned. Now, because they're more likely to get caught in the act, people have resorted to other means to eliminate their opponents. Better treatment options increase the likelihood of preserving human life for those who have suffered a poisoning. In some cases, even the quality of life after an accidental poisoning or even an intentional poisoning has been improved. As Christians called to the daily battle on terrain that is manipulated and clouded by our enemy, we must learn to stand guard against all the wiles of the devil. Among his arsenal of spiritual weapons is the clandestine poison of bitterness. Bitterness, as a destructive tool of Satan, is a spiritual poison which, once rooted in the human heart, can spring up to destroy years of spiritual discipline and character growth. It can wreck relationships in families. It can assail the walls of a marriage. And if left unchallenged, bitterness can sap away the strength of our relationship with God. Let us as Christians be vigilant. Don't chew the wallpaper. Examine our own hearts to purge out any root of bitterness.